from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The temporary extension of debt granted to Greece by the country's creditors under an agreement reached late last week and approved by the European powers that be Tuesday has produced a good deal of controversy among the international left, with some calling it a sellout by Syriza of its campaign promises. Syriza had wide support among the Greek population last week when a poll showed 81% of the Greek population approved of its handling of negotiations up to that point. Observers say the big challenge underlying the interim deal that was announced earlier this week is whether or not the people of Greece will accept the four-month extension. Meanwhile, there was more tough talk from Germany. The German finance minister said Greece will not be receiving any funds until it meets the pledges of its current bailout program. Press TV's Konstantin Venizelos filed this report from Athens.
As if internal Syriza party reactions were not enough to create some tension in the government against its decision to extend the current bailout agreement by 4 months. Now we have the German finance minister who has used this political situation in Greece as an easy argument. Mr. Schäuble says that the Eurogroup decision to approve the Greek request for a bailout extension was not easy. Simply, he said, because the Greek government said one thing, promised one thing to Greeks before the elections, and quite another later in the negotiations when it actually caved in and applied for the extension of the current bailout agreement. So we see this decision, basically, Bardia, backfiring for the Greek government, not only within the party itself, but also it does actually provide, quite obviously, an argument for Germany to say that, you know, how can we trust Greeks when they say one thing one day and quite another the next.
But not everyone on the left believes that it's time to abandon Syriza just yet. Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and visiting professor in international affairs at the New School in New York, said it's premature to judge Syriza. We spoke with him by telephone Wednesday, and we'll bring you that interview in its entirety later in this newscast.
The Senate will receive a message from the President of the United States.
That was the sound in the U.S. Senate chamber yesterday as the Senate received notice that President Obama used the third veto in his presidency to block a Republican bill which would have allowed an express approval of the Keystone XL pipeline by bypassing a State Department consistency review to determine if the project is in the national interest. Senate Republicans have said they will attempt to override the veto, but it's unclear if they have the votes to do so. And the veto does not mean the White House will ultimately block the pipeline's approval. The White House press secretary issued a statement saying that the veto, quote, does not represent a specific position on the pipeline itself. It merely says that the benefits and consequences of building that pipeline should be thoroughly evaluated by experts and through the administrative process that has existed for decades, closed quote. We will continue to follow this story as it develops. Monsanto, the U.S. corporation that's widely considered to be the world's most influential global agricultural conglomerate, is coming under heavy fire in Latin America for what experts have called the devastating impacts of the use of toxic agrochemicals and genetically modified seeds, which some say are wreaking havoc in the lives of millions of farmers and helping to spread serious disease across the region. Press TV's Manuel Gafani has more.
While the American company is accused of lobbying some regional governments to prevent them from passing key environmental regulations, some NGOs and political parties are now fighting a legal battle against the U.S. giant and have started a campaign to stop its operations in the region. Monsanto has already faced legal setbacks in Colombia and Chile, and now Argentine environmental organizations have obtained a favorable ruling from a federal court.
Monsanto was willing to install a huge plant in Argentina, but the people took to the streets and we managed to halt its construction. At the end of last year, we also managed to block a bill in Congress that ensured Monsanto's property rights over the lands of the farmers. We will keep our fight against them.
Most of the agrochemicals marketed by Monsanto in Latin America have already been banned at the European Union and the US. Lack of appropriate regulatory policies and corruption have turned the region into a breeding ground for experiments of this U.S. corporation, which reaps unprecedented profits at the expense of the lives of millions of people.
Monsanto, like Chevron, is one of these international giants that bribe MPs, privatize the natural resources and the biodiversity, and wipe out entire communities just for the benefit of their few shareholders. They're willing to turn our countries into a U.S. colony.
Latin American public health officers have reported thousands of cases of cancer, birth defects, and other severe diseases linked to the use of Monsanto herbicides like glyphosate. After global protests and the decision of South American farmers to cut their production using Monsanto products, the U.S. corporation saw its earnings fall 34% last year. Manuel Giuffoni, Press TV, Buenos Aires.
The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia will hear over the objection of Pacific Gas and Electric and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, a case brought by Friends of the Earth, alleging that the NRC illegally allowed the utility to alter the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant's license. Friends of the Earth contends that the NRC acted in secret and in collusion with PG&E to hide the reactor's vulnerability to earthquakes stronger than it was built to withstand. For more, we spoke with Harvey Wasserman, a journalist, author, and advocate for renewable energy who's been a key strategist and organizer in the anti-nuclear movement in the U.S. for over 30 years. We spoke with him by telephone Wednesday.
What's happened at Diablo Canyon is that we're fighting on many, many fronts to shut these two reactors, which are surrounded by earthquake faults. And that's the source of the latest situation. The U.S. Court of Appeals, federal court in Washington, D.C., has agreed to hear a case that centers on the fact that the Nuclear Regulatory and the Pacific Gas and Electric Company conspired to weaken earthquake safety standards at Diablo Canyon when revelations were made that the there was more seismic possibility there than have been originally believed when they built the plant. Specifically, there was an NRC inspector official working at Diablo Canyon named Dr. Michael Peck. And Dr. Peck, in light of new information, concluded that Diablo did not meet the license requirements to continue to operate because of newfound seismic possibilities. And so rather than talk about making Diablo Canyon stronger and meeting these safety standards, the NRC and PG&E just changed the license requirements. And, you know, this is illegal, for God's sakes.
Yeah, this is without public notice, without any hearings, or without any investigation from the outside at all, right, which is all required under
totally
NRC regs.
Yeah, it was done in complete secrecy. And so it's very rare that the courts will get involved with nuclear issues. The Atomic Energy Act of 1954 pretty much makes the nuclear power industry a law unto itself. But in this case, the violation is so obvious and egregious that the court has intervened. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to see it our way. And that doesn't mean also that a decision that does go our way won't be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But there is so much else going on with Diablo Canyon that this is a very encouraging development. One of the other things that's happening that's extremely important is that the plant does not and has not for a long time meet state and federal water quality requirements. They're pouring way too much hot water into the ocean. They're killing billions of marine microorganisms, and the water is hotter than is allowed under the Clean Water Act. Now, they've been getting away with this for a long, long time. We hope that the state Water Quality Board will intervene now and require PG&E to build cooling towers, which could cost anywhere from $2 to $14 billion. Now, if they are required to do that, they're going to have to go in front of the California Public Utilities Commission to force the ratepayers to pay. Now, the CPUC has generally functioned as, you know, an arm of the utilities that they're supposed to regulate, but in this case, PG&E and Diablo have become so unpopular that it'll be a major political upheaval, and we think there's a reasonable chance this is going to happen. So we'll see, but there's a huge groundswell now in California to shut these two reactors. We have successfully, within the last couple of years, shut two reactors at San Onofre between Los Angeles and San Diego. And these are a big deal. These are very big reactors. There was a huge legal and regulatory uproar and a major successful grassroots campaign. So prior to that, the Humboldt reactor has been shut and the reactor at Rancho Seco. So these two reactors at Diablo are the last two in the state. And, of course, California has become the epicenter of a huge shift to renewable energy. Solar power and wind power are just booming in California. And there's really no need whatsoever for the power from Diablo Canyon. It's extraneous. It's, you know, and getting rid of these two reactors will open the floodgates for still more renewable energy to come forward. So this is a very big deal. If we win this in the courts, I think Diablo will definitely shut. And in any event, it does help us on the other fronts. We have people, for example, in the San Francisco area, the Bay Area, who are trying to organize Code Pink. Cynthia Papermaster are trying to organize a rate revolt where people withhold all or part of their electric bill in protesting at Diablo.
On Thursday, lawyers for imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal will present their case at a hearing in the federal courthouse in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, seeking to block a new Pennsylvania law that would allow the government to censor inmates and the news media. The law, called the Revictimization Relief Act, was enacted in response to Abu-Jamal's October commencement speech at Goddard College and is an apparent attempt to prevent him and other state inmates from having a public voice. For more on this, we spoke with Prison Radio's Noel Hanrahan, who's been recording Abu-Jamal's commentaries for many years.
The Pennsylvania Fraternal Order of Police really is motivating this, and they got the legislature to pass a law trying to take away the pencils and the microphones from inmates in Pennsylvania, and specifically targeting Mumia Abu-Jamal, but really any inmate that they want to suppress and silence and censor. So the governor in October signed this law. It went immediately into effect. It allows victims and the attorney general or district attorneys on behalf of victims to civilly sue both journalists and prisoners to prevent them from recording and broadcasting information that's really critical for the public. So it's a full-on attack on prison radio, on Mumia, and on any prisoner who wants to tell the truth from inside Pennsylvania prison.
The temporary extension of debt granted to Greece by the country's creditors under an agreement reached late last week and approved by the European powers that be Tuesday has produced a good deal of controversy among the international left, with some calling it a sellout by Syriza of its campaign promises. For more on that, we spoke with Richard Wolff, economics professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, via telephone Wednesday. Professor Wolff, we have seen that there is an interim agreement reached between the Greek government and its creditors, and there are screams from various parts of the left here in the United States and elsewhere in Europe over this, people calling it a betrayal. Could you first lay out what actually happened and then your interpretation of it?
Well, what actually happened is one more in an elaborate set of dance steps. These dance steps, this time in a written form, are the efforts of the major parties here, which are Greece on the one hand, with a silent partnership of the Spanish and other countries that are in a similar desperate state, and on the other hand, Germany and some of the other countries in the European Union, whose position is that Greece has to continue on the austerity that their people voted against and continue to pay the debts that no economist in his right mind currently believes the Greeks can pay. So they're in a negotiation forced by the victory of the left-wing Syriza party, which got a mandate. Nearly half the Greek people voted for the one party, it never happens in Greece, to do exactly what the Syriza program calls for, which is to sharply reduce their debts and to reorganize their society so that it has economic growth instead of the crippling austerity that they've had. And all you've seen over the weekend is the usual noise. That is, those people who are terribly afraid, and those are the screams you talk about, terribly afraid that the Syriza party will do what other left-wing parties in Greece, particularly the Greek Socialist Party, did 3 or 4 years ago, which is run an election, win on an anti-austerity program, but then end up administering the very austerity they claimed they had been against, something which the French socialists are now dying because they've done the same in France. So the screams are Syriza is going to do that. The fact of the matter is that is one possibility, but we don't know. We are very early in the game. Syriza won the election a month ago, and it is way too early to draw a conclusion as to what is going to happen as this drama plays out.
Syriza has been approached. I know last week there were reports. Well, there was an actual visit by both the foreign and oil ministers of Venezuela and Ecuador, first to Moscow to meet with the oil minister there, and then to Athens. And during that trip, it was mentioned by the Ecuadorian foreign minister that giving preferred terms in like through Petrocaribe, for example, to various countries in the southern hemisphere here, had helped them buttress up their negotiating position, basically with the creditors, because they were getting oil where they were able to defer half the payments and with incentives to do social investment and such. And they were citing this on their way to Athens. Is there the possibility that Russia, Venezuela, Ecuador will be rolling out some things to help Greece strengthen its negotiating position, and these things need time, and that's what they're doing, is buying time?
Yes, that is one, that's perfectly reasonable scenario. If I told you that I knew such a thing had happened, you should probably end this interview.
Right.
The only people who know that are the people in those rooms, right, and they are sworn not to have a public discussion. That's why the screaming that you referred to, and which I know did occur, is, to be as kind about it as I can, premature. Is it possible that Syriza will cave in and behave like the Greek Socialist Party before it, like the French Socialists? Yes, that's a possibility. Syriza is a coalition, and there are no doubt voices within it that are afraid of pushing forward for fear of what the Europeans, which is a polite way of saying the Germans, want and will, what might be willing to do. But there are equally other forces inside Syriza who are not interested in a retreat, not interested in going the way that the socialists in France and Greece before them chose, in part because they've seen the collapse of those socialist parties in the wake of their betrayal of their anti-austerity election campaigns. And for those people, working some deals out with Russia, with Latin America, with the People's Republic of China, on a whole host of issues, such as oil payments to keep their energy system going, but also on all other kinds of assistance, would be a logical and appropriate thing for the Greeks to do. If the Europeans, and I think they will be making a tragic mistake if they do this, but if the Europeans literally mean that they're going to stick with their hard bargaining position, the one they've articulated over most of the last 3 years, then they are really leaving the Greeks with only two choices. Either capitulate, and that reproduces everything I've just said, would be a capitulation that is self-destructive for Syriza, or to go ahead with arrangements with other parts of the world that are not behaving the way the Germans are, and also means, in all likelihood, a very profound internal, even you could even call it revolutionary situation inside Greece, because you will leave Syriza with no option but to get the funds needed to run their society, to get out of the desperate conditions austerity has given them, by taking the wealth from those who have the most of it, the rich in Greece, the corporate sector, and putting it to work for the mass of people. And I, for one, think that the Europeans will regret having transformed what is now a discussion over debt repayment into a wholesale social revolution in one of the European countries, since that will be a model for other countries in Europe to then think about in a way much more immediate and much more urgent than is now the case.
And, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about the politics in Spain that are, you know, waiting on this.
Right.
But before that, let's say that the Europeans remain intransigent and Syriza does the Grexit route. What happens inside Greece? What happens to the Greek economy in that outcome? In other words, this is the alternative that's being held out by many on the left. What actually happens if you do that?
Well, again, I can answer the question, but the answer I give you has to be hedged about with qualifiers, since nobody can know in advance what will happen to all the different variables that will come together to provide the actual answer. But here's a general scenario. The first thing is that Greece will revert to its own prior currency, the drachma, instead of participating in the euro. That will mean a quick and sharp decline in the value of the Greek currency. The drachma will be a very cheap currency. You'll be able to get a whole lot of drachmas for a euro or a dollar or a British pound. And so then the next question becomes, what will that mean? Well, it will mean for the Greeks that they have to spend a lot of money that they don't have buying what has become a very expensive imported goods. That's, for example, why you would want to cut a deal with oil providers so that in the collapse of your own currency, you don't find it impossible to get the oil, the gas, and so on that runs your economic system. On the other hand, the other side of the coin, it will become very, very cheap to buy Greek objects because they will be priced in drachma that have become themselves very cheap. It will mean that every wealthy or middle or upper income citizen of Europe or of North America contemplating a vacation in Europe will go to Greece because the cost of a hotel, the cost of a restaurant meal will become much cheaper there. Tourism is an enormously important product, an enormously important activity for the Greek people, and they could see a spectacular surge in demand for Greek vacations as they become much cheaper than the alternatives elsewhere in Southern Europe and North Africa. So you'd have to go down the list of all of these different issues to see how a devaluation of their currency, because that's what this now means. See, the Greeks can't do that now, because if they're part of the euro, it's the whole euro community that decides the value of that currency. The Greeks cannot go it alone. If they pull out, well, then they can, and they can cheapen their own currency. And this is, by the way, what the Greeks and other small countries have done in the past when they've had economic difficulties. So that's to be likely what they would do now. If you wanted to make their lives unbearable, you could try to prevent the Germans, for example, who are major tourists in southern Europe every summer. The Germans might make it impossible or difficult for their citizens to go to Greece. This is a kind of economic warfare that is perhaps the best metaphor to use here. The Germans have been waging economic war on the Greeks by imposing an austerity regime on them, harsher than anything done anywhere else, although close to what's done in Spain, Portugal, and Ireland. And the Greeks are now saying, well, we're not going to continue to take this assault. We're going to do a little counter-economic warfare of our own. That's what they're trying to negotiate now. If those negotiations don't work out, then the economic war escalates. And as the sad history of the world shows, the line between economic warfare and military warfare gets fuzzier and fuzzier as the escalation in the economic warfare continues. By the way, that's one of the reasons behind the remarkable statements of President Obama over the last 3 or 4 weeks, when he has pretty amazingly counseled the Europeans that they ought to find a place to accommodate the Greek demands for loan relief, because that's a lot less dangerous a political direction to take than the hard line that at least verbally the Germans keep championing. I think Obama and his advisors realize that Syriza and Greece have many stronger cards to play than the European press is willing to admit, because they can, and they will have little choice but to convert a struggle over debt into a social transformation at home at the expense of corporations and the rich. And this brings a leftist solution to the problems of Europe into a much stronger position and bolder relief for all Europeans than the folks who now run the European economies are likely to want or to be able to stand up to. I don't want to over-dramatize this, but the behavior of Germany vis-a-vis Greece right now is the behavior of an entrenched oligarchy that seems able or willing to move in the direction of what could become civil war if they don't change what they are saying and doing.
You know, it's interesting that the timing of the Greek government, Syriza, bringing up the issue of reparations for the last actual war between Germany. And it's also interesting to bring up the idea of a leftist example of a solution to the problem that faces much of South Europe and even Central Europe, because with the elections towards the end of this year in Spain, and Spain with the relationship that it has with Latin America, where this example has already been demonstrated to be a successful model, you could see dominoes fall rather quickly in Europe.
That's right. And the election scheduled in December in Spain, when you couple that with the absolutely stunning rise of the Podemos, the Spanish for yes, we can, the Podemos movement that is borrowing from the Syriza experience, using it with its own interpretation, of course, but using it as a bit of a model of how to proceed. Let's be really clear. Greece is a very small country on the periphery of Europe. Spain is the fourth largest economy in Europe. Greece owes $300 billion. The Spanish debt, I believe, is in the neighborhood of $2 trillion. So you're talking about a society which, if it were to go down that road, means that the Greek issue, broadly defined, is rapidly becoming the European issue.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.